Bearing Witness, part of the Racial Reckoning Project, is a reflective dive into the week's events unfolding in this season of racial upheaval and, we hope, change. Each week, we will compare notes from the week's events, connect the dots to past and present experiences and racial patterns in America, and connect with community members from many different perspectives who are themselves trying to make sense of this moment. I'm Anthony Galloway, Executive Director of the Arts Us Center for the African Diaspora.
And I'm Georgia Fort, an independent journalist.
I imagine one of the reasons people cling to their hate so stubbornly is because they sense, once hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with the pain. James Baldwin. I could give a lot of James Baldwin quotes this week in particular, when he talks about trying to remember what we believe as well as what they do and cause you to endure does not testify to your inferiority, but to their inhumanity. There are so many different reasons. In a week where we saw somebody drive their car into demonstrators, when we are gearing up for next week's sentencing of Derek Chauvin, as we commemorate the anniversary, the unfortunate and tragic anniversary of Duluth lynchings. There's been a lot that has happened since the last time we were together on Bearing Witness. So Ms. Georgia, I'm going to kick it over to you quick, just because there's so many things happening that we want to make sure to put in front of us as we engage our conversation and bring in our special guests today. So Ms. Georgia, catch us back up for the week.
Absolutely. On a federal level, we saw Joe Biden sign the bill into law that Juneteenth will now be a federal holiday, and some mixed reviews. Some people very celebratory, other folks saying it is not enough. It's not tangible change. It's not real change. But nonetheless, it is, I think, hopeful to see these conversations surrounding racial reckoning approaching a national level. On the other hand, Minneapolis has again become the epicenter of this movement around police accountability. The only difference between last summer and this summer is it feels like this time the world is not watching. It feels like the world has turned away, that they're tired of hearing this story, even though it's still unfolding right here in our backyard. After nearly 2 weeks of daily protests surrounding the death of Winston Smith, a vehicle drove into a crowd of protesters, killing Deanna Marie. And protests and vigils continued at that space up until recently. The mayor reached out to the governor asking that the National Guard be activated once again. And I found myself as a journalist at somewhat of a pause, because I'm covering these stories, I'm following these stories, and then also I am consuming the national news. And I can't help but ask myself, how are these series of events not making national news? How is it not making national news that we have a Black man who was killed by a federal task force that did not have body camera footage? You have the attorney come out and say that she did not see him with a gun. You have, similar to what happened in Charlottesville, which did make national, if not international, news, you have a vehicle drive into a protest, kill a woman. And then now the National Guard is activated. But it has become so commonplace in our country to use the military against our own people here on our own soil. It has become so commonplace that it's no longer newsworthy. And when you internalize that, it makes you reckon with the reality that we might be embarking on or in the middle of some type of civil war. I don't understand how the National Guard can be deployed, be activated, and it not make national news. But that's because this has become so commonplace.
And just to be clear, right now, I saw in your reporting that the National Guard is on standby, quote unquote, in case protests turn violent. But the only violence that we've seen has been on the part of somebody outside of those trying to attack protesters. you know, as we talk about the historical pattern pieces of this, right, this fits right into that pattern that we see over and over again. And you touch on a couple of them. You know, we I think in an earlier conversation, you know, we are stuck in a place of being sick and tired of Black blood needing to be the sacrifice, needing to be the perverse altar for which our consciousness in the United States seems to be tied to, and wanting to disconnect from that tragic pattern, while at the same time seeing our quote-unquote advancement that folks have tried to make for years. The Juneteenth bill, the making Juneteenth a national holiday has been something that has been in the works and on the lips and on the minds of communities for years. And now it rings to us hollow and bittersweet. I actually had a sense the moment that the news broke. As the universe works, I was reading again Frederick Douglass's speech, "What to the Slave is the 4th of July?" And I have a very similar wondering, what to the United States is Juneteenth in this real space? I mean, there's a hollowness to it that definitely rings there as well. You also touch upon a pattern, though, of forgetfulness. One of the things as we come into the space of celebrating Juneteenth, one of the first things that happened after General Gordon Granger was forced to Galveston, Texas to read Special Order Number 3 is people speculating, or people going to the sense of moving, quote unquote, beyond, and this surprise at the civility of the celebrations and all these news articles that showed us what we really thought about us. And I can't help but to see a correlation between this moment where folks had been fighting hard to be directly connected to the horrors that this country has had put forward, and wanting to continue that conversation, and seeing that because of the end of the Civil War, that all of a sudden the space for that type of organizing, even the words and the conversations around abolitionists, went deathly quiet after this conflict had ended and shifted to something else. And I see, you know, that we may be in the midst of another similar shift. We saw similar shifts after the Depression era organizing and work that happened after the work in the 60s around voting rights. And when the Civil Rights Bill was passed, we see this low point, this what's called the nadir period of folks trying to forget or quote unquote move past. And so that is definitely of particular concern as you give those stories and lay out those patterns here. I'm curious, as people continue organizing and continue trying to keep this front and center, and national and international attention starts to wane, we're going to start seeing the real grit, the real commitments that folks have made in lip service tested in this capacity coming forward. I'm curious as what you see coming in and those tests that are to come.
Well, I think the test is really going to be on corporate America. Mm. Corporate America, who made all of these economic promises to, make more equitable communities, to be more equitable in terms of their vending lists, to be more equitable in terms of those who they hire, just explicitly going out to give away money to Black businesses. It was all of these pledges that were made last year, hundreds of millions of dollars that there hasn't been much accounting for. They haven't explicitly come out and said, hey, you know, we gave this money to this company. We gave money to, we don't know where that money went. No one is really tracking it. And so I think, and I've started to hear these conversations come up in different spaces where people want to start approaching corporation by corporation and asking them, this pledge that you made, where did it go? Hmm. But to your point about lip service, we saw so many statements about racial equity and racial justice last year. And now there's crickets. You're not hearing anything. For this community to have endured the murder of George Floyd, then, you know, the fatal shooting of Dante Wright, then now here Winston Smith, you know, is you just only show up when there's camera footage. You only show up when it's horrific and it lasts 9 minutes and 29 seconds. Hmm. You know, like, so all these different things. But I do think that we're at a turning point. And people are tired, Anthony. People are really tired of coming out and making these demands and getting that lip service. Oh, yes, we're here for you. Things are going to change. I think even about this week when 65,000 physical signatures were delivered to the governor's office. We're more than a year past the murder of George Floyd, and there still hasn't been meaningful legislation passed. So I think people's claims of there being a lot of lip service are very valid.
You're listening to Bearing Witness with Anthony and Georgia, created and supported by AMPERS, KMOJ Radio, and the Minnesota Humanities Center, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For our full conversation, please visit racialreckoningmn.org. You know, I think it's a great time to bring in our guest, who is no stranger to holding space for all the levels and reasons that you have just described. Tish Jones is the executive director of True Art Speaks, and you've seen her involved in many different projects all around, but one that I have found a special place in my heart for is the Village Project. That is being coordinated as a Black healing space. And I'm so thrilled to get to participate again for that in the amazing work that this sister has done in community to hold space for many different folks. So welcome to Bearing Witness, Tish.
Give thanks. Glad to be here.
So you heard me and Miss Georgia kind of recapping what's happened throughout the week. And so the first thing that we always do is give a chance for our guests to kind of respond to what you heard us talking about and what's coming up for you as you listen to some of that recap throughout the week.
You know, the first thing that comes to my mind is the readiness to provide a reason for harm enacted by persons of European descent against non-European folk in community, right? So the phrase visibly drunk has come up. I don't know what it means to be visibly drunk. You know what I mean? I just have not heard that before. Typically, you have to go through some sort of test to figure out whether or not a person is actually inebriated. But that phrase has been being tossed around. Also, you know, speculation around mental health is a really interesting thing. So white folks get afforded reason before many other folk are afforded reason and without any proof or any merit. And that is the first thing that came to my mind when just hearing about Nicholas Cross and, you know, this unfortunate, really, it is an unfortunate situation because a woman lost her life and other people were injured, right? I think that's something that we need to address. Like, we really need to address the pattern of that, the history of that, the ways in which that is a consistent violence that is enacted upon our community and other BIPOC community members in terms of the ways in which we're forced to try to empathize with folks who cause harm. And whether drunk or not, that doesn't speak to a person's intention, right? So there's a way in which something is being excused before being investigated. And I think that, you know, we have to learn how to lean into the hard conversations is something that I'm thinking about, you know, because Winston Smith was not offered those same reasons, you know, and we're, you know, for those reasons to be applied to a person who chose violence or who ended someone's life, right? In the same exact space. And while people were holding space and grieving the loss of Winston Smith's life at the hands of police, Winston Smith should have also been afforded those reasons, right? And not been misquoted and, you know, framed in this terrible way by the Star Tribune, right? Which they just had to redact and pull back some statements because they said some things that were unfounded and unsubstantiated. But that's what happens to Black folks, right? We got to get in control of the narrative, y'all. That's the thing that's coming up for me. Like, we got to really think, we have to get out of the way so that people can be fearless and feel like they have permission and support to use their voice, right? So that additional stories can surface. And once those additional stories surface, then we have narratives, new narratives, counter narratives, right? And that's where the narrative shift and the narrative change happens. You know, our organization is built around narrative, you know, a lot of narrative change and narrative shift. That's the crux of why we do storytelling at our organization through the arts. And that's been my work since I was a baby, right? Those of us who grew up under the griots in our community, that's what they've been teaching us this whole time, is to tell our stories and not be afraid to use our voice. And if we don't do it, you know, we will be painted as the perpetrator.
This, you just blew my mind. And it happens often when I talk to you. So let me just name that as a pattern that I actually enjoy. But there's something to our ancestral practice, simultaneous spot, no time. I just want to repeat these words back. I don't have a time capsule on this. I don't know that we're not simultaneously in these spaces and you know, consistency at the same time, which actually tracks to our guiding cultural ethos throughout generations of African thought and philosophy. So that just got my theological brain just swimming right now. But also your reference to Octavia Butler, and the first thing that comes to my mind is Kindred. So I don't know if it's directly there, but she has so many writings. But, you know, even in that space, being forced in a position to go back through time to care for an abuser in order for your existence to remain and constantly fight to get back home to a white spouse. Like that kind of question raising, folks. I mean, Octavia Butler's deep. Huge plug to read, amazing author, Octavia Butler, futurist, Afrofuturist, philosopher, you know, prophet. prophet, prophetic. But that's where my question comes to. There's if we're going to look at all the patterns, both the negative and just all the patterns, because, you know, I don't want to put the false binary on it, right? But if we're looking at all the patterns, there is also the pattern of the prophetic voice that comes forward. All the folks that you name began with prophetic voice. Harriet spoke a prophetic vision about what is to come before the activity that she undertook to undermine this horrible institution. Nat Turner spoke of a prophetic voice. We can't forget the pastoral philosophy that undergirds Nat Turner's space of prophetically speaking about a space that of what could be. We gotta think about John Brown's prophetic voice, right? Spoke a prophetic vision of the world as it should be. That precedes the action that needs to be taken to get to that space. And I'm just curious, you know, right now we see attacks on even the ability to tell our narratives. We started this conversation with the narrative and we see that we have no choice but to start telling and enshrine and bolden and what's the word? To undergird our ability to tell our own stories, because we have federal policy attacks and state policy attacks on the ability to even tell a narrative, juxtaposed to the same hypocrisy that we've lived in, the duality that we've lived in this United States, where we passed the bill for Juneteenth while turning around and saying in so many different places that we want to ban even the ability to talk about why Juneteenth matters as a national holiday anyway. So this dissonance that's already there. So I'm curious to see what prophetic voices or patterns are you encountering that you know, you've already brought forward Octavia Butler's work. I'm curious about your prophetic voice about the world you wish to see and what that looks like for you.
I'm going to answer your question by complicating your question, because I don't think we can talk about prophetic voice when we're having such a hard time listening. I really want to end there, but I know I need to figure out how to draw that conversation out, because it's really like, for me, it really like, that's the soundbite that I think is really what it is. How are we going to hear it? So, I mean, how deep you want to take it, right? Because there's the, you know, there's the house Negro and the field Negro, if we're really talking about it. And there's ways in which it's, and I'm not saying, you know, it's, we have to, there seems to be a way of some folks who believe that we are free, and some folks who are, it's a little harder to listen to the need to fight. We're not in agreement on
how to approach the battle. We're not in agreement on to the approach on how to save ourselves. We're not in agreement on the approach of what we need. We're not. So it's hard. It's hard for me to figure out how we're discerning a voice in the middle of having so many different ways of listening and hearing and receiving a message, right? And then a varying idea of freedom because we've been poisoned for so long. You know, for some folks, freedom is a lot of money and assimilating into this capitalistic system, right? I'm not saying either of those things is right or wrong. For some folks, it's, you know what, let's just move back to the farmland and raise our food, you know, as toxin free as possible. The earth is polluted. I don't know how that works out, but, you know, let's move out to the rural area now and do that. They can have the cities back. To some folks, it's let's bear arms. And if it comes down to it, clack, clack, it comes down to it. Right. I think we all have these different ideas of how to do the thing. So I'm curious about a prophetic voice. I think another thing that the institution has done really well is make activism sexy. So the prophetic voice is selling Cadillac cars. Yep, I said it. The prophetic voice is hopping out of Cadillac trucks on major television talking about how they always wanted to be an activist. So now, something we've never had before, we have an activist selling the babies a dream of how from a young age, what like the career, I've never imagined in the world that we would be talking about career activism, especially when activists, Black activists go missing. They die in burning cars, but we have well-known and touring activists hopping out of Cadillac trucks on TV, glamorizing activism and the desire to be an activist as a career that will result in possibly you owning a Cadillac truck. That, so I don't know what the prophetic voice sounds like when you're competing with all these other voices. And it's hard to hear what the revolution sounds like.
That's so complex. And in covering specifically the city coming in to try and, as they said, reconnect 38th in Chicago, I, as a journalist, was looking for both sides of the story and quickly realized that there were three. And there wasn't a lot of conversation about this because the first day when the city came in to really try to reopen the intersection where George Floyd took his last breath, that day was also the same day that Winston Smith was killed. And I never got a chance to go back and look at the way mainstream media covered that story, because usually mainstream media really prides themselves in telling both sides. But on that day, there was not two sides. There was three sides. And the reason why I think about that after what Tish said is because there was a group that was pushed forward to represent the Black community. And there was also another group that had been working to preserve space. And so I think that your analysis is very accurate. And every time I see these divisions, it definitely fractures the movement, but it's very painful to see. How do we unify? How do we unify, Tish? How do we mitigate those divisions and come together cohesively as a collective to move forward and agree, like, this is the direction, these are the things that we need? Is there a way to do that?
You know, all of the wonderful Black folks that I've read and respected, and all of the Black folks that have ever taught me, even if they have diverged from some of what their words were when I was coming of age, when they were forming my mind, it was never about being in full agreement. We never had to be 100% like all Black people are, we feel this way and we're doing this thing. We all had a common goal. The common goal was our liberation, though, right? We're not going to do a thing that's going to derail our liberation. our collective liberation. I think that, one, for me, if we can get back to keeping the main thing, our collective liberation, not your family's liberation, not your family's financial wealth, not your family's political clout, not your personal agenda, not your desire to be the most well-known, the most recognized, the most quoted, the person with the hashtag on the cover of the local magazines, getting hit up by, you know, CNN and ABC and NBC and all of that, but our collective liberation. What is going to be best for Black people? What is the thing that is going to keep all of us alive and breathing? How can we all eat? How can we all survive? What is the kind of education that we all need? What should be passed down to generations? What is working for our collective liberation, right? And removing our egos so much so that we can receive when we are wrong. We can apologize when we make a mistake. We are brave enough to say, I don't know. I did not know. Unity to me, what I was taught, involves humility, education, and a collective goal.
This has been amazing, eye-opening. I hope that anybody who's listening here understands that the collective and the many voices that are important and powerful that are needed for that type of collective. Oh man, I'm sorry. That's going to preach a long way. So I'll make sure to cite you, Tish. But I'll pass it over to you, Miss Georgia. This has been Bearing Witness. I want to thank our guest, Tish Jones, Executive Director of True Art Speaks. And I want to thank you, Miss Georgia, independent journalist who's been documenting this movement and helping us to bear witness as only you can. So I'm going to kick it over to you to end this like we do every week.
In the words of Dr. Joy Lewis, may the revolution be healing.
This is Bearing Witness.
This has been Bearing Witness with Anthony and Georgia, a part of the Racial Reckoning Project, The Arc of Justice, a journalism project created and supported by AMPERS, Diverse Radio for Minnesota's Communities, KMOJ Radio, and the Minnesota Humanities Center with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Programming on this station is supported in part by Minnesota Department of Health.
My name is Jamez Antoine Powell, and I'm a local musician. A bigger push for me would be getting back together with my church choir and getting back to music, and things starting to feel normal again. So what I would tell someone who isn't getting the vaccine because they think it isn't safe, I'll just tell them just to try to get factual information. I mean, after I started talking to medical professionals and talking to people at my pharmacy, talking to the pediatrician at my children's clinic, as more information has been coming out about how exactly the vaccine works and how they've developed the vaccine, that just kind of helped me get over my own personal fears.
COVID vaccines are safe and effective. More information about the COVID vaccines, including how to find a vaccination site near you, is online at vaccineconnector.mn.gov.